Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, has Hollywood finally gone too far? That's the question some are asking. No, not when it comes to the reliance on franchise blockbusters or going all in on streaming. No, the New York Times reports that the industry is suddenly getting very nervous about Me Too aftermath and going overboard on diversity inclusion. They've finally gone too far with all this diversity nonsense. I'm here for that. Look, this is what the great Brooks Barnes reports anyway, right? In a piece last week, he noted that studio execs in the midst of belt tightening are looking at projects that were rushed into production in the name of diversity and having some second thoughts, in part because of the disastrous box office results for Bros, which was marketed heavily as the first theatrically released gay rom-com, and Easter Sunday, which was marketed as a huge step forward for the Filipino community. Hollywood execs all of a sudden cold feet looking at those box office grosses. Meanwhile, you know, Warner Brothers shelved and then wrote off the Batgirl movie that was headed for HBO Max that they spent like $90 million on, despite the fact that it was, quote, starring a Latina actress, featuring a transgender actress in a supporting role, written by a woman, produced by women, and directed by two Muslim men, end quote. No mention, of course, of whether or not it was any good, but we'll never know, because it got written off for tax rebate. I think one unnamed exec kind of summarized the brunt of Barnes's piece when he said that after Me Too, the studios hired nothing but women and people of color. They were trying to cover their asses. And he thinks that few of them can actually do the job they were hired for. Again, that's his sentiment, not mine. I would never say such a thing. Meanwhile, the automatic death sentence that was imposed on many accused Me Too transgressors is over. That has been lifted. John Lasseter, Johnny Depp, James Franco, they all have jobs lined up, projects in the works. Lasseter is basically the head of an animation studio again. Or you can just look at what transpired with Bill Murray earlier this month, right? First, it was revealed that an accusation of sexual harassment against him led to a project being shut down mid-shoot. They still haven't finished that. There's no word on whether it's going to be finished. Then it was revealed that he paid off the accuser for what was either, best case scenario, a joke gone terribly awry, worst case scenario, an unwanted forcible advance. And then the month ended with Bill Murray being featured in the trailer for the new Ant-Man movie. It's really hard to imagine something like this happening 2 years ago in the midst of the Weinstein-inspired backlash against bad Hollywood men. This is all framed as a bad thing. You know, the headline is in perfect time style, right? After Me Too reckoning, a fear Hollywood is regressing. But maybe a little regression isn't the worst thing in the world. Audiences aren't particularly interested in having their entertainment also be the thing that preaches at them about how the world should look, right? And the post-Me Too habit of ritually excommunicating anyone from the fold who has transgressed even slightly was, let's be honest, untenable. It was untenable, unworkable, and that probably should have been done away with a while ago. But then I am a middle-aged white man, so my opinion on this issue is inherently suspect. Is it not, Alyssa?
I thought the framing of this piece was really weird, in part because it clutches together two separate movements. The, you know, Me Too movement, which was about, you know, sexual harassment, rape, and the abuse of power, and the attention to diversity as the Black Lives Matter movement went nationwide in 2020. And those are both important movements. But they're driven by sort of different imperatives, different sets of data. They have, you know, sort of different demands to a certain extent. And treating that all as a Me Too thing, I think, blurs some important dynamics. And I think it's true that both of those things are being reassessed or, you know, or being rolled back on some level. But it strikes me that there are a couple of different things going on here. You know, I think on the sort of on the Me Too side of the ledger, there has been, you know, part of the entire premise of Me Too was that, you know, the most grotesque offenders may have been outliers, but they weren't the only part of the problem, right? That, like, Harvey Weinstein is an extreme, but it's not like there's Harvey Weinstein and then everyone else, you know, behave perfectly and beautifully. It's like, the movement is called Me Too because it's about a widely shared experience for women. And, you know, Me Too in Hollywood has, you know, I think led to some specific changes. I think, you know, the kinds of non-disclosure agreements that silenced a lot of women for a really long time have become less acceptable. You know, I think things like, you know, intimacy coordinators on sets, however much people make fun of those, you know, I think that's actually been valuable for some people and is probably going to be sort of a longstanding practice. But yes, you know, it was totally bizarre to me, for example, that, you know, that story didn't mention, you know, Warner Brothers and Ezra Miller, right? With, you know, this is someone who is being accused of a just huge array of troubling behavior in a way that, you know, seems to impinge on his ability to be a productive member of a set or, you know, promote a movie sort of on any reasonable level. Like, I have no idea what the press tour for The Flash is going to be like, except that we all know it's going to be completely bananas and probably awful. And to not mention that at all. I mean, that's one of the seemingly one of the really prominent examples that should be in the mix. Just seems strange to me. Now, the movement for more diverse content, more sort of opportunities for people to make content, comes out of a very different movement, set of circumstances, measurements. That, you know, women are included on that list. I mean, work like Stacey Smith's at UC Annenberg, you know, there have been all of these sort of counting projects that have documented how undiverse Hollywood is for a very long time. But that is not the decision to try and greenlight more work by a wider range of creators, telling a wider variety of stories, starring a wider variety of people, stems from, you know, a very different reckoning and set of circumstances. And, you know, I think that this was always one of the potential weaknesses of the movement, right? There is this assertion that there is a huge market for content of various kinds. I mean, for example, you know, Hispanics and Latinos go to the movies at some of the highest rates of, you know, any demographic group, and yet they're wildly underrepresented on television. And so there is this theoretical case that, hey, you know, there are markets here for, you know, more shows about Muslims, more movies, you know, more black male action leads, whatever. And then some of that content gets made. Those shows or those movies get held up as, you know, sort of make or break for the entire concept. And then when they break, everyone has an excuse to walk away. So you have the failures of two different movements that are being clutched together in a strange way. And it strikes me that the piece doesn't get at the sort of two different sets of dynamics going on there.
Well, I mean, to your point, putting them together, I mean, it did feel like we were hitting this kind of intersectional moment, right? Like this moment when everything was kind of coming together and, you know, people were saying, well, it's not enough to just make sure there aren't harassers. We also have to have roles for women. We have to have women execs. You know, it's not just that we need to get rid of Oscar So White and have better representation in the Academy. You know, we also have to make products for these people and for these communities. It did feel like there was a moment where everything was coming together, and it also feels like simultaneously, like, and in part because of the streaming revolution and the kind of splintering of all audiences everywhere, that it all is blowing up at the same time.
Right, but I also think that, you know, something that isn't mentioned here is there's just going to be a huge amount of content contraction, right? I mean, the numbers on the new Hollywood economy do not particularly add up. And when everyone is, you know, spending $17 billion a year on content without necessarily a mandate to show a profit because you have to grow the audience, then all sorts of things are going to get greenlit, especially if you think that they will make people stickier as subscribers. But we are about to be in the middle of a big contraction in the amount of content that gets made in Hollywood. Maybe not immediate, but it's coming around the mountain. And, you know, the stuff that is going to be easy to cut is by people who, you know, don't have as big name recognition, where they don't have a fan base built in. They're not a big star. And so it's like, it's nice for Leslie Grace that she got cast as Batgirl or whatever that movie was. But like, there isn't, you know, a legion of...
I can tell Alyssa was really excited about it.
So excited. But there's not like a legion of Leslie Grace stans who are going to storm David Zaslav's house and like make him release the Leslie Grace cut. Like that's not going to be a thing that happens. And, you know, in a world where even, you know, a J.J. Abrams project is getting cut because it's expensive, there's just going to be a lot of cutbacks. It's going to start with a lot of the stuff that has smaller audiences or, you know, less powerful creators. And, you know, for a piece like that to not mention the economics is just really strange, right? I mean, yeah, like Johnny Depp wins this lawsuit against Amber Heard. That is definitely a seminal and really upsetting moment for the Me Too movement. But also, Johnny Depp is a huge star. He has started in a lot of reliable IP, and that's what studios are going to feel more comfortable putting out these days. So I think that, you know, yeah, this is a story about movements spluttering out, as movements often do. Like, I've been through a few cycles of the Hollywood diversity movement over the 10 years that I've been doing this, and, you know, that things wax and wane. But also, you know, having completely blown up their entire economic model, of course the industry, you know, when faced with bad headwinds, is going to cut stuff. And of course, that is going to fall on the stuff that feels marginal to the core business, even if it's politically uncomfortable.
Oh, well, Peter, isn't you're a student of the streaming business environment and the economics of streaming. Wasn't the promise of streaming always supposed to be, look, every niche is going to have a home. We're gonna have stuff for everyone over all these different channels, you know, Netflix in particular, like that was always their thing. We're gonna have it all these times. But like everyone was kinda like, we need to attract 15 different 2 million person groups for our service and then we'll be set.
Netflix in particular was pretty explicit about the fact that they wanted to replace the old network TV model. But the old network TV model, you know, was that you would have three shows that aired every night that would, and each of them would attempt to kind of appeal to everyone in America. That's a little bit of an exaggeration, but the idea was for each one of those shows to have as massive appeal as possible, you know, at any given primetime hour or half hour of network television. Netflix wanted to appeal to everyone in America, not by producing one thing, but by producing as many things as possible and then making sure that every single little niche was served. And in some ways, they have done, I don't know if exactly that, but they have made like a surprisingly impressive attempt at doing that. You know, we talk about Netflix, their business prospects, and we occasionally talk about their shows, but there's just a huge, huge amount of stuff that Netflix produces every year that nobody notices, that doesn't get any sort of, certainly maybe not nobody, but that doesn't get any kind of critical attention, any kind of press, and in some ways isn't designed to, because they're putting it out there and hoping that it reaches the intended target audience. I think that some of that, maybe even a lot of that, is actually going to continue. So Alyssa's totally right that we're going to see a contraction in content spend. Stuff that would have gotten made will not be made, and there's sort of, the cuts are going to come, I think, at two ends. They're going to be really big, ambitious creator project, you know, auteuristic things, you know, that just cost way too much money. Like the Irishman will not be made, basically. The Irishman 2, let's say, right? Which I know we're all very excited about, the Irishman expanded universe. And then the other thing that's not getting made are sort of small projects by upstart creators who don't have a track record and who can't prove that, like, I make money or I have made money, right? It's going to be sort of this stuff that kind of consistently makes money on a reasonable budget. That's going to continue to be made. So a lot of superhero movies and a lot of horror. And, you know, probably there will be another big star rom-com that comes out after, you know, given what we've seen with Ticket to Paradise and the box office there, that sort of thing. So the really big swings and the kind of novel small stuff is what's going to get hurt there. But that's just a function of economics. That's what, right? Like when business is tight, when household finances are tight, what you cut out are like the little tiny weird things that are experiments and the really big ambitious things that you're also not totally sure are going to work. And you sort of pare down to your core business. I do think Alyssa made a really good point that this piece is kind of oddly conceived and smashes together two different movements, sort of the diverse casting movement plus the reckoning with sexual assault, you know, off camera. But it's also just like this piece is just sort of an extended whinge in some ways, and like sort of a, like, it's just a bunch of people who are disappointed that Hollywood is not a nonprofit dedicated to social change. And I want to be clear, nonprofits dedicated to social change are awesome. I work for one, but that's what we tell people who give us money. Like, we have a mission and we're going to pursue it even if we don't make money. And Hollywood, their business is to make films that people will see and then make more money off the tickets they sell and the other stuff they sell than it costs to make the movies and advertise them. So when you have all these sort of novel projects, like a lot of which are just sort of like diversity box checking exercises that I think frankly set back the diversity in casting and, you know, diversity in creators movement just by virtue of being not very good and looking like obvious sort of diversity, diversity box checking exercises. When you have that sort of thing, like that stuff is not going to survive for very long. Even in a pretty good economy, because ultimately the numbers are going to, it's like the numbers won't be there. In when you head into a what looks like a recession or at least strong economic headwinds, which every big business is preparing for right now, then that stuff is going to get cut because, again, it's not a cause. It's not a mission-driven nonprofit. It's not Hollywood likes to think that they're there to change the world. They are there, in fact, to buy ever larger houses in Beverly Hills for their executives.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that, you know, all of these things are, as folks sometimes say in the industry, they're all execution-dependent. So, like, The Woman King is good. It's good. It's a solid movie. It's a solid action. It appeals to an underserved audience. They're going to make their money back on that one. Though they're not going to, it's not going to be an enormous, it's not going to be a Black Panther style hit, right?
But on that tip, just since you bring up Black Panther, one thing that we should add to this is that some of the casting decisions made during this period are going to have long tail effects because they are part of big IPs that are going to extend for the next decade or so. And so obviously Chadwick Boseman very, very sadly is not going to be around to be Black Panther, but like Marvel realized, oh my goodness, we can make Black Panther and we can have a cast of largely Black actors, right? And like do really well, and like that's, and do really well with that. And like Marvel is going to keep, like Marvel's going to keep that thing going even past the death of its star. Like there is going to be a long tail of those casting decisions when they are made around big IPs, I think. And if those movies basically worked and audiences came out to them, then it's not like Hollywood's never going to cast another minority actor. Like there, or you know, those roles aren't going to continue to exist. I think there have been lessons that, you know, Hollywood has learned that some of those things actually do quite obviously make a lot of money.
Well, and Black Panther is a good example in that it is a both and pitch. It's like a both pitch, right? It's not an or pitch. It's not like, please go see this movie because it's socially significant and it's a good thing to do. It's like Black Power and also fights and superheroes and like hyper technological African nation and CGI budget.
It's a Marvel movie. It's like, but it's also better than Eternals, right? Eternals, yeah, is another Marvel movie that was kind of pitched as like, look at this super diverse cast of characters that we've got here. And that movie was not good.
It was not. And it was weird how much they leaned into the marketing of, you should see this movie because of the diverse cast.
It's always a bad sign.
Like, it's possible that Hollywood is bad at its messaging around, like, I think one of the lessons that Hollywood took from the reckoning sort of after George Floyd and from the sort of casting questions that were part of Me Too was that what people want is to be sold that their consumption is important, right? And I think for the most part, that is not true. People want to be sold that their consumption is going to be fun. And, you know, some of this stuff failed because Hollywood marketed it as vegetables. And some of it, you know, we talked about Billy Eichner going like way overboard in selling the sort of historical significance of Bros instead of, you know, the fact that, and we'll talk about this in the bonus episode this week, like it functions in a lot of ways like a Nora Ephron, like highly location and subcultural specific romantic comedy. And that it's like, it's fun and it's kind of hot. And, you know, that is a mistake. And, you know, some of this is failing because of larger social stuff, whatever. Some of it's failing because an industry that has not been good at telling a range of stories historically, it does not have the built-in muscle memory to sell those stories effectively.
It is kind of funny that Billy Eichner ended up doing the kind of annoying thing that his character's flame in the movie is constantly like, maybe you shouldn't be annoying like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's his, I mean, Billy Eichner himself is not, should not be undercounted as a problem with the marketing of that movie. Just like, because his whole persona is like, I'm the super annoying guy. Come watch me for 2 hours. Like, I don't know. But, like, we're going to talk more about bros in the bonus episode. But it does feel, you know, I had Scott Meslow on my other podcast, Bulwark Goes to Hollywood, talking about his book about rom-coms. And one of the things that he talks about in his book, is the way that the Judd Apatow machine kind of pitched 40-Year-Old Virgin and Knocked Up less as rom-coms and more as, like, hangout comedies. Like, these are... when I was reading that, I started nodding along because I remember thinking to myself, categorically in my head, like, all right, 40-Year-Old Virgin, this is more like a movie like Old School or something like that. And if Bros had been pitched more that way instead of, like, hey, important, come see this important movie for the importance, I think it might have had a better chance. But, you know, it's a hindsight 2020, all that. All right, we're running along here. What do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Hollywood seems to be taking its collective foot off the gas pedal on the issues of diversity and sexual harassment? Alyssa?
This may surprise everybody, but I think it's non-controversial because Hollywood was always going to revert to the mean.
Peter?
I basically agree with Alyssa. I mean, the underlying issues are obviously controversial, right? Like the Me Too stuff was, sort of built, centered around very real, genuinely controversial issues. What's happening now does not strike me as obviously controversial.
Yeah, it feels like a controversy for all the reasons you guys mentioned, but like, you know, there was some definite overreach, and a correction was inevitable. I think is the most careful way I can put that. So that is how I will put it. All right, make sure to tune into this week's bonus episode. As I said, we're going to be discussing the romantic comedy Bros. It's the end of rom-com week here at Across the Movie Aisle. It's going to be following our episode on Ticket to Paradise. Speaking of which. On to the main event, Ticket to Paradise, a movie in which Julia Roberts and George Clooney basically play Julia Roberts and George Clooney as they jet off to a fabulous island destination and act charming around one another and smile big for the camera and make us all feel warm and comfortable and safe, and they give us a few laughs and a few tears, and then they send us home after 105 minutes with a gag reel on the way out the door. The end. I loved it. More or less. I mean, it was fine. As I wrote in my review of the movie, Ticket to Paradise is very aggressively not reinventing the rom-com wheel here, right? It's a movie about people who were once in love, Clooney and Roberts, who have been divorced for 15 years or so when the movie begins, and whether they will fall in love again as they concoct a series of misadventures in the hopes of getting their daughter, played by Caitlin Dever, to back out of her forthcoming marriage to a seaweed farmer she met just weeks before. All of this plays out against the backdrop of Bali, where the hijinks feel even more important than thanks to the very pretty setting. This movie feels like a replacement level mid-90s or early aughts rom-com, right? It's got two huge stars. They're reminding us just how effortless it is for them to be really cool on screen, how to translate their big smiles and their soft stares and their distant thousand-yard stares as they contemplate the nature of their relationships and existence itself, right, to the rest of us out in the real world. But that in and of itself is a bit of an oddity because they just don't, they literally don't make movies like this anymore, really. I mean, it's hard to find a comp, a good theatrical release comp in the last 2 or 3 years. They definitely don't make them on the big screen. And even on streaming, where most of the rom-coms have kind of migrated to in the last few years, we've mostly seen a younger generation of actors and actresses who I'm no knock on them, but they do not have the charisma of Clooney and Roberts. It is pleasing just to look at them. And that's not nothing, but is it enough? I mean, Peter, I went exceptionally easy on this movie in my review because I frankly don't think too much of the genre in general. It doesn't do anything for me. I don't put a lot of stock in like when it works and when it doesn't. I don't quite understand it. Is what I'm saying, I think. And it succeeded for me from my POV because I'm not looking for anything great here. I'm just looking for something kind of pleasant. Is this just the soft bigotry of my own low expectations working its way into my work?
Sonny, I think if your question is, are you the problem? The answer is always yes.
Well, I mean, that's a given. That's a given.
So I did not despise this movie, but it's not good. It's just tepid and empty and shallow, and it suffers from what I think is the biggest problem that plagues a lot of kind of populist rom-coms going back decades now, which is that it's not just about beautiful people in beautiful locations, it's about beautiful non-specific people in beautiful locations. And they don't, there's nothing to them, right? And so there's this phrase that screenwriters sometimes use about finding the universal in the specific. This movie attempts to find the universal in the nothing. Like, the only real things we know about George Clooney and Julia Roberts, who are, as you pointed out, like, not even playing characters. They're just playing the avatars of Hollywood glow that both of them represent, because they're not playing anything. The only thing we know about them is that, like, she's works in the art field and he's an architect or something like that. And this never is relevant to any of the proceedings. It's like not anything, you know, they don't talk about it in any sort of specific way. Work is not in, like, really interrupting them. They're not like, they have no problems. They have no personalities. And they have no personalities because this movie does not, is like, it has, it like, does this rom-com thing that I really hate of depriving them of personalities, because if to give them anything specific would be to ground them in a real world that might turn off the type of viewer who loves this sort of frothy fantasy. And I do not. There's a really telling moment that I think reveals that this movie just does not have any kind of specific theory of love and connection and attachment, which is, I think, a big problem for a rom-com, though it is a common one. But so the plot is that George Clooney and Julia Roberts go to Bali to, like, stop their daughter from getting married to a guy from Bali. And there's a little scene after one of the conversations that George Clooney's had with the fiance about, like, how marriages break up and they don't last. And the daughter and her fiance are sitting, you know, in the midst of tropical paradise. And he's like, well, you know, how is our relationship going to last through all the hard times? And she looks around and her response is, I'm sitting here in the most beautiful place in the world and all I can look at is you. It's literally, it's not anything about the person. It's just, he's hot. He's hotter, I guess, than the plants. Like, that's it. It's he's hotter than a pretty sunset, and that's what's going to keep them going when they're 72 and, like, and infirm, and, like, that's, I don't
see the issue here. I mean, my biggest problem, frankly, is that I didn't believe that Julia Roberts and George Clooney would ever break up. They're too pretty not to get along forever.
Right. So compare this to a movie like Licorice Pizza. And I have said before that I think P.T. Anderson is the only Hollywood filmmaker who understands love, because the whole thing about every single romantic relationship that P.T. Anderson has ever given us, whether it's in Phantom Thread or Punch Drunk Love or Licorice Pizza, is that they are irreducible. They're not relatable in any, like, it's just a bunch of completely weird and random things that are incredibly specific to the person and the place and the context. And that's what makes his movies and his relationships so rich and so real on screen. And this movie has absolutely no theory of how people get together or why. And it just doesn't have anything to say about love. Now, you can make a movie that has some of those elements and that is still quite popular, as long as the bits and the scenes are really quite funny. And so I will end with my theory of romantic comedies, which is that we only need one, and it's When Harry Met Sally. When Harry Met Sally is so perfect and so great in every line, in every shot, in every scene, it's truly wonderful, and it's what every other romantic comedy since has wanted and tried to be, which is, you know, upper middle class people who don't really have that serious problems. They live in a city, and, like, they're pretty well off, and they have fun jobs and good friends. They eat out, and it's, like, kind of, you know, it's, they bicker, and, like, that's, and they're clever, but, like, they, you know, they, there's every single scene in that movie works perfectly. It's truly a delight, and it shows that this genre can be elevated and perfected. And Ticket to Paradise doesn't have a single memorable scene, much less a half dozen of them.
Yeah, I guess what Peter's saying, Alyssa, is that we should retire the romantic comedy forever. I'm fine with that. Are you? Is this a dead genre? Should we get rid of them?
We're taping this on Halloween. We should use a Ouija board. We should conjure up the ghost of Nora Ephron, and we should ask her to tell us how we can repent for our sins as a people so we can deserve her second coming. No, this movie made me sort of actively irritated because the three key actors in it, George Clooney, Julia Roberts, and Caitlin Dever, who I think is wonderful, like not in this, but I just in general, I love seeing her on screen. I think she is terrific. I don't know if any of you, if either of you watched Unbelievable, the Netflix series, the sort of miniseries adapted from a big ProPublica story.
We watched it for the show.
We did watch it for the show. I'm sorry, guys. You know, I It's been a while. I had a baby. There's been a lot of stuff going on. But so all three of them are like, this is an excellent way to measure how good the three of them are as actors, because the material that they're being fed is absolute garbage. And yet you still want to watch them anyway, right? Like, Peter, I would push back on you and say that the one memorable scene in the movie is George Clooney sitting at the bar and telling his daughter's college roommate about, you know, building the lake house for his wife.
I agree. It's the best scene in the movie. It's still it's actually a bad monologue, though. It's not well written.
It's a bad monologue, but it's like the gap between what the material is and what Clooney does with it. Like, you know, it's like a wins above replacement stat in acting, right? It's like, what can George Clooney do with this relative to what everyone else could do with this? In the same way, it's like, what can Julia Roberts do with like a moment where she is called on to look like rueful that relative to what everyone else in Hollywood can do? Like, you know, how limpid-eyed can Caitlin Dever get relative to everyone else in Hollywood? And so in that sense, it is a nice measure of what these particular actors are capable of. But it's such garbage material. And Peter is absolutely right that this movie never convinces you that any of its couples should be together at all, right? I mean, like, you know, George Clooney is entirely correct that his daughter is going to get bored with being a Balinese seaweed farmer, like exporting stuff to Whole Foods, unless like she uses her law degree to like formulate a business plan and have them like go big as like ethical seaweed marketers or something, right? But like Lily is not a person. She's a collection of characteristics. And so there's nothing to suggest that she's not looking forward to being a lawyer, that she's like burned out, that she only did this because it's what her parents wanted. And again, like you said, Peter, you know, there is nothing to suggest that she has found some like part of her personality in Bali rather than that she's found a hot guy. And, you know, the bickering between, you know, Georgia and David is so acrimonious and like, you know, substancelessly unpleasant that it doesn't make sense that they would get back together, right? Like the movie makes a very credible case that they never should have been together in the first place because it is actively unpleasant to watch them be like pick at each other in the first couple of scenes. You have no sense of what brought them together in the first place. It's just aggressively unpleasant. And if you compare this to a very different romantic comedy with an equally ludicrous scenario, I feel like you can see the difference between them really clearly. There, in the movie I want to talk about is the 1995 romantic comedy While You Were Sleeping. Have either of you seen this movie?
The Sandra Bullock, Bill Pullman one?
Yes. It is a ludicrous movie. Sandra Bullock is a Chicago, like, token taker on the Chicago L. She has developed a crush on this passenger who comes through her turnstile every day. He gets pushed onto the tracks and like is unconscious. She saves his life. She sort of accidentally blurts out that she's his fiance and then gets taken for such by his like wacky extended family while he's in a coma and has to try and like pull this off, all while falling in love with his brother, who's played by Bill Pullman. The movie is full of character detail. You know, you learn a lot more about like Lucy as a person who's sort of hopes and dreams were thwarted when she was orphaned. You know, she has this relationship with her supervisor. You see her being, you know, getting brought into this family and that filling like a real gap in her life. You find out that the guy that she's been fantasizing about is just a complete jackass on all sorts of levels. And, you know, you see the characters at work. You see them in family settings. It's incredibly specific and talky, and it's absurd. But because it's about actual human beings, and because the actual human being at the center of the story learns something and changes over time, you believe everything that happens in it, even though it's ridiculous. And Ticket to Paradise is also a ridiculous movie, but it doesn't care about its characters as people at all, and as such, it is totally unconvincing, even given the range of acting talent that it brings out.
I find this whole rant to be outrageous. George Clooney learns a great deal. He learns that all two people need is to be kind of attractive and be together, right? He decides his Trojan horse metaphor is terrible. It doesn't make any sense. The scene that you highlight, the him at the bar, is fantastic because it's literally just George Clooney saying nonsense while holding a glass, and the camera pushes in on him kind of at an angle, and he looks wistfully off in the direction that's like just over the camera, and it's like, oh, that's what stardom is. This scene is what being a movie star is. And they're mostly dead. There are very few people left alive who could pull that sequence off, and George Clooney is one of them. So I'm gonna be sad when he passes from this plane of existence, because there's no replacing him.
And similarly, some of the other casting's pretty blank and bad. Just in particular, the French airline pilot who's supposed to be
French Army Hammer,
who's supposed to be Julia Roberts' beau, right? And there's a bunch of like.
They obviously
badly,
hate each other.
Pretty badly executed physical comedy. And I was just thinking, since we saw The Lost City earlier this year, that like how much better Channing Tatum would have pulled off the exact same role, the same direction, like the same movie. I'm not asking for like changes, except Channing Tatum plays hot idiot goofball who like kind of is weirdly physically awkward for being an incredible specimen. The only problem is it would have imbalanced the romantic prospects of the movie because Channing Tatum would have been too compelling.
Well, in that case, you would have had to have Channing Tatum get together with the roommate who Clooney is talking to, right, in that bar sequence, which is what I kind of thought was going to happen anyway. I just assumed that they would give this guy a soft landing by being like, here is the attractive roommate. Go be attractive with her together. But they didn't even bother with that. This movie's really very misandristic, if you think about it. It's mean to all the men in it. I don't care for that. No, I thought it was fine. I don't know, man. Again, I have very low expectations on this sort of thing, so it worked for me. But let's put it to the rest of the panel. What do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Ticket to Paradise? Alyssa?
Ugh, thumbs down.
Peter?
Thumbs down. If you want to see this kind of movie, go watch the Bullock Channing Tatum one, which I didn't love, but is much better.
Thumbs up. It's fine. You people have your expectations are too high for this nonsense. It's fine. It's fine. All right. That's it for this week's show. Make sure to swing by atma.thebulwark.com for a bonus episode on Friday. Make sure to tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we will die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.